I'm going to talk for about 40, maybe 45 minutes. And I'm going to talk about the geography of Slowdown. I've written a book very recently called Slowdown. The subtitle is The End of the Great Acceleration and Why It's Good for the Planet, the Economy and Our Lives. It's a result of 6 years' work looking at a series of data sets of changes over time. And what I found was that what I think is happening in the world is different to what many people think. Many people think, or at least they thought before the pandemic began, that everything was speeding up, that the world was going faster and faster and faster. And it's understandable why people thought that, but it is possible that there was a slowing down before the pandemic began. And a lot of the graphs I'm going to show you are borderless, so about trends that are worldwide. And I'll give you some guesses as to why this may be going on, but I'm far from sure myself. You can now see you can now see a traditional graph of population growth in the world. It starts about 12,000 years ago in 10,000 BCE when the population was very low. You can see it hardly rising at all over time. But then, around about 2,000 years ago, we have a slow and steady rise and then a sudden acceleration about 200 years ago. And we go to 1 billion people, 2 billion people, 3 billion, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Projected to be 10 fairly soon. And that is the traditional image that's given of population in the world, kind of out of control growth, out of control change. And not just population, everything else. The amount of food that we're consuming, the amount of animals that are grown on the planet for our own use, the amount of iron ore that we dig out, the amount of pollution we create, everything is not just going up, it appears to be accelerating. So what I want you to do is to step back and to think, is that actually true? Is everything really accelerating? Now, you can see a dot moving. Is that okay? Yep. I think you can see a dot moving, hopefully. And that dot is moving on a special kind of graph. And this is a graph which shows you two things at the same time. One thing is the total population, which is along the y-axis here. And the other thing is the rate of change in that population, which is along the x-axis, the horizontal axis. And we're looking at an imaginary country called No Such Land. A country which had 100 million people in 1950. And that population was rising and rising in 1960, 1970, 1980 at about 2% a year. So that by 1985 it had got to 200 million people. And by around about 2005 it had got to 300 million people. And by 2020 it had got to 400 million people. And you'll see that the dots get bigger and bigger. And that the space between the dots begins to get wider. And this is acceleration. This is something that is, if you like, almost out of control. Although it looks like a straight line, you can see that very, very quickly we're going to get to 500 million people, a billion people, 200, 2 billion people, 3 billion people. I've got a quote by the side of this graph, which is a quote from Charles Darwin, who talked about how occasionally in the life of a species, and human beings are a species, there are a few favourable seasons when there is a population explosion. And that's what's happened to human beings. This graph is showing you what deceleration would look like. Again, we're going to start in 1950 with a country. Again, with around about 100 million people. And again, the population is rising by about 2% a year. But it rises by 2% then by 1.9%, by 1.8%, by 1.7%, by 1.6%, by 1.5%, and so on. Until 1970, it's not rising at all. And then it falls by a tenth of a percent, two tenths, three tenths, and so on. And you can see the population coming down to 80 million, coming down to 40 million by 2017, and eventually getting to zero by 2070. So this is deceleration. The absolute population is on the y-axis, the change is on the x-axis. Let's go forward. We're going to look at real data now. That was just imaginary data. Now, the interesting thing for me is that things that we thought were accelerating when I looked at them turned out not to be. This particular graph is about the amount of money that university students in the United States borrow so they can go to university. And the little red dot is currently climbing to around about 2018, when it was about $1.5 trillion, $1,500 billion. An enormous amount of money being borrowed by students in the United States to go to university. But if you look carefully at the graph, you'll see that it splits into two time periods. One from 2006, when the data began, to 2009, when there is acceleration, going higher and higher all the time, peaking in autumn, normally when students go to university. And then it changes around about 2009 after the financial crash, and it's still going up, but it's now leaning leftwards. So the rate of change is no longer more and more and more debt all the time. Let's look at something completely different from student debt. I just wanted to show you student debt because that's something we think is growing uncontrollably, and I wanted to show you that it isn't. Wikipedia. You might think of Wikipedia as a database, a collaborative database built by people when they choose to do it around the world that will be getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And it is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Along the y-axis of this graph, you can see how many million articles there are in Wikipedia. And on the x-axis, you can see the rate of change of that. Wikipedia began around about 2001. And at first, it did accelerate. More and more articles being added every year, more than the year before, until 2007. And then, the number of articles that were added was not as much as the articles that were added the year before. And less in 2009, less in 2010, 2011, 2012. Still rising, but rising less quickly. Little acceleration in 2015, 2016, but then it slowed down again. Why does Wikipedia slow down? Because there are only so many articles that you can actually add to Wikipedia that people really want to read. It doesn't make sense to people to want to read endless information about more and more obscure things. So that's another example of something that you might think was accelerating uncontrollably, but actually only did so for 7 years at the beginning of its existence. And you can find the same with all kinds of data in the world. It is not accelerating uncontrollably. Here is something that still is accelerating uncontrollably. It's the emissions of CO2 in the planet. The planet is absolutely borderless if we think about carbon dioxide. And so by 1998, we were emitting 25 billion tonnes of CO2 a year. By 2008, it was 30. By 2015, it was 35 billion. And you'll see it's accelerating again, 2018. Not just going up, but going up faster than before, moving this way. It has to get over that line before it actually decelerates, which it only did in a recession in the 1980s, recession in the 1990s, hardly at all at the end of the 90s, and the Great Recession of 2008, I'm afraid, didn't take it over the line. So there's emissions of carbon rising and rising and rising. So there are a few things. Carbon is the first, which is rising. Now, if you're wondering why I'm using this kind of a graph, it's because it shows you the detail. In this case, it shows you, for instance, when we have a summit at Rio, or another summit at Kyoto, or another summit at Paris, we tend to actually get accelerating emissions after the summits because we think we've done something about carbon emissions and then we become a little bit lazy, perhaps. Or it's when economic growth in the world was highest. I'm going to show you now what this looks like on a normal graph. Now, you may say a normal graph is very easy to understand, and you'd be correct. his carbon emissions going up and up and up. But what the graphs that I've been drawing, they're called phase space diagrams, highlight, are when things go faster, for instance here, and when they go slower, for instance here. And it brings out the detail of that kind of change over time. Why do carbon dioxide emissions matter? They matter because they are the primary reason for temperature rises on the planet. Now, the temperature record is complicated. The carbon dioxide graph is relatively simple, particularly when it's drawn in a conventional way. But here's temperature. And this is compared to the 1951 to 1980 normal. So around about 1950 to 81, it's around zero. And you'll see that after the Second World War ends, we haven't quite got there yet. Oh, we have. It begins to rise and rise and rise and rise, and particularly rises quickly out of recessions. So by 2018, we are almost at 1 degree above that 1950 to 1980 normal. And the graph is sloping that way. It's sloping to the right. So global temperature is not just rising, it's rising faster on average each year than the year before. So CO2 and global temperature, they're the only two things I've shown you so far which are accelerating. I'm going to show you a whole series now of graphs about population. I'm going to do it quite quickly because I have far too many graphs, but it's something we can be fairly sure about. And population matters. Because it's the kind of denominator for everything else. If our population were accelerating uncontrollably, then there really wouldn't be much hope for reducing carbon emissions or much hope for future temperature. But it isn't. The graph, the conventional graph I showed you at the very start, is misleading. Here's the world population graph, but now shown in a way which allows you to see that yes, we had acceleration in the past. We particularly had fast acceleration after 1850, when it zooms like this, and even faster after 1940. But by the 1960s, something was changing. So that it began to increase more slowly, and then the increase was the same all the way from the 80s through to now, and there was a projected slowdown in population such that it may get to 11 billion shortly around 2100, but it may not. These are the estimates that the UN produced in 2017. When the United Nations updated them in 2019, then they did not look to be quite as dramatic as this. But that's an incredible slowdown. I'm going to put it on a different scale now for you. This is a log scale to show you've had slowdowns before. The first slowdown was after 1492, and you can see it there. A century from 1500 to 1600. And that slowdown was due to people arriving in the Americas with diseases and many millions of people dying in the Americas after Christopher Columbus and the other invaders arrived. Second slowdown occurs after 1820. And this is most closely associated with colonialism and the British invading many, many countries around the world. Initially reducing the greater population growth, but then helping cause exponential growth, very fast growth, 1850 through to 1960s, and then the current slowdown. The current slowdown is different from these other slowdowns. This is the invasion of the Americas. This is the colonialism of the British and other European powers. This is people choosing to have fewer children. So it's a very, very different pattern to before. Let's look at some individual places, individual countries. So start off with the United States. The United States is a rapid population acceleration country. The little dot is now in the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, when it was about 150 million people. You can see that acceleration in 1955 increasing by 3 million people a year. 1997, almost 4 million people a year. But since then, it's been decelerating, and it's projected to carry on decelerating. But the United States is unusual. There are very few places in the world that are expected to still be growing by 2100 very much, and the United States is one of them. I must speed up because I want to end on time in around about 30 minutes or so. Here's China. And these graphs will be strange to you. You haven't seen graphs like this before, so don't worry if you find it hard to understand. But China is a good example, I think, of that initial slowdown in the 1830s, 1840s due to colonialism. You can see it here, the Opium Wars and the British. And then an acceleration in population to 1951, a deceleration, an acceleration again, and a slowdown. Slowdown actually began before the one-child policy. And when the one-child policy was lifted, we still had a slowdown. And China is projected to get down to a billion people before, or around about 2100. It's only 80 years away. Population in China drops to a billion. Those are the UN projections. It may well be faster than the UN project. Let's have a look at all the countries of Africa. The countries of Africa are interesting because they had an acceleration that went on longer through the 1980s and 1990s and 2000s, longer than much else of the rest of the world. And that was related to policies of the World Bank and so on, particularly structural adjustment and removing the funding of schools. Because if you do not have people going to school, particularly young women going to school, when they're 15, 16, 17, you'll have faster population growth. But even Africa, by 2060, deceleration is predicted by the UN based on what is happening currently. And I'll show you individual countries a bit later. And population stabilizing between 4 and 5 billion people in future. Going to go forward to a tiny little place, which is the British Isles. Really remarkably unimportant nowadays, much less than 1% of the world's adults, far less than 0.5% of the world's children live in the British Isles. This is Britain and Ireland together. When you look at a small place, you get a lot more perturbation because of individual events. Our biggest rise in population recently was to 2008. This is people coming from Eastern Europe who we invited in. The biggest fall was the Irish famine in the 1840s, which you can see there. So let's give you an idea about what it looks like for a relatively small set of countries. But again, set to stop rising around about 80 years from now. Population below 90 million people. Small country, or collection of small countries. Collection of big countries, the Indian subcontinent, where you are at the moment. Again, accelerated rises in the 60s and 70s have slowed down, so that by the year 2000, population was growing the fastest it would ever grow, just over 20 million a year. And by 2064, just 44 years from now, the population is set to fall to 2 billion by the year 2100. Right? This is what a slowdown looks like. This is the projection that is almost certainly going to happen, if not faster than this. Because as I say, these are the 2017 UN figures, the 2019 UN figures are for faster population reduction, and demographers around the world think the UN may well be overestimating the rate of growth. It may fall even faster than this. Smaller country, Japan, but one of the most dramatic countries for current slowdown of population. You can see the effects of the Second World War here, and the actual falls in 1945. After war, you often get a baby boom, which we did in Japan to 1948, and then an acceleration again from 1960, the children of the baby boom. But by 2010, 10 years ago, population was falling. And the fall to come is quite huge, from 130 billion down to 80 billion within just 80 years from now, if current trends continue. The only thing likely to stop that would be increased immigration to Japan. There's no sign of any increase in the number of children that people are having. The rest of Europe and Asia. So this is all of Europe and Asia, excluding the Indian subcontinent, excluding China, excluding Japan, and excluding the British Isles. Just to show you that it's happening everywhere. And the date in this case, for the rest of Europe and Asia, is 2063, by which population should start falling. You may be getting a bit tired of population by now, so I'll go faster. Oceania, just for completeness, this really is almost all Australia, and then next biggest New Zealand. You can see gold rushes early on. You can see the effects of migration, high in 1950, high in 1968. And the projection really is anybody's guess after 2008, but this is still for a reduction to come in future. All the rest of the Americas, Latin America, South America, North America, excluding the USA, which I showed you before. And as I said, the USA is unusual because the Americas are slowing down even faster than the USA. 2061 is when population should begin to reduce in the rest of the Americas, long before it does in the USA. Although if the USA does economically badly, as it is at the moment, its population may well slow down much earlier, because why would you migrate to the USA when there is so little economic opportunity in the USA at the moment? What's driving this? It's babies. It's people having less and less children. You can see both these graphs are the same. One's on a scale that zooms in most recently, the other one goes from 1960, but you can see the average number of children that people have in the world by 1992 falling to 3, by around about 2008 falling to about 2.5. Incredibly fast fall in people having children worldwide. And we can look at the USA. And in the USA, you'll see that it comes below 2 and then circles around. The USA has the highest fertility in the rich parts of the world. But even in the USA, it finds it very hard for fertility to go over 2. The majority of the reason for the world population still rising is not babies, it's people living longer. As the number of children we have, as the number of babies we have reduces, we are going to have population stability in the future. China. Much, much smoother curves. And again, this great reduction occurred before the one-child policy. Incredible reduction from 5 to 4 to 3 children by 1978. And then you see a loop that replicates the earlier, larger loop, because if you have huge reductions before, you get an echo of a baby boom and a baby slump later. China actually has mildly rising fertility now, but rising so slowly, between 1.6 and 1.65 children per couple, it really is not going anywhere. And with the pandemic, it actually, and the economic crash before the pandemic, which was beginning, it slowed down. Niger, one of the poorest countries in Africa, where people were having 7.6, 7.8 children per couple in 1978, heading to almost 7.9 by 1983. And then look what happens. Now, it's a straight line because it's based on estimates by the World Bank, but still, it is a remarkable fall since the year 2000 in the number of children that people are having in the poorest parts of Africa. That's Niger. Look at somewhere like East Timor here, and the effects of invasion and war. And when you have invasion and war, you get rising fertility. East Timor went up from 4.5 children to 5 to 6 by 1994 to 7 by 2000. But since then, it has also fallen rapidly. Or somewhere like Guatemala, which had many, many civil wars, but actually managed to have falling fertility throughout that whole period. Haiti. Haiti throughout the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s was around about 6 children per woman. Incredible population growth. But then from 1986, a bit earlier than those other countries, you begin to get this incredibly fast fall, almost at 2.5 children 4 years ago, almost certainly there now. France. Didn't happen much earlier. 1970s, 1975. Just over 2 children per couple. We're getting less and less of a difference between places in the world. The falls that occurred in France a long time ago occur far faster now, in other parts. The UK, again for completeness, similar to France. South Korea, far faster. Quite incredible. By 1983, two children. By around about 1999, 1.5. This graph ends in 2016, but I can tell you, early this year, it was reported that the average number of children in South Korea is now 0.99 per couple. Less than one per couple. That means a halving of population in a generation in South Korea. If you don't have migration coming in. Portugal. Again, very similar European patterns to what you've seen earlier. But more importantly, Brazil. Far greater population, and look at Brazil coming down to wiggle around at 1.8, 1.9 at most, 1.7, 1.6 children since 1984. Just trying to get you an idea of how fast this has gone down. You'll be glad to know that that's the population fertility graphs finished. I'm just going to show you a few other things in the world to try to give you an idea. It's not just population which is slowed down. This is GDP. Conventional way of looking at GDP, which you can see by this measure, growth peaks in 2006, there's a crash of 2008, recovered slightly by 2010, but not to its 2006 level of growth. 2017, again not. And of course we know, 2020, this will be way over here. Global economic recession we will be in now. But it was 2006 that was the peak by this conventional way of measuring GDP per capita in the world. However, if we look at it using a log scale, and then you can look at 1950 or perhaps 1964 and say they were the peak. And since then, there's been a slope going leftwards. Average GDP growth in the 1950s was higher than average GDP growth in the 1960s, which was higher than average GDP growth in the 1970s, which was higher than average GDP growth in the 1980s. Now, what happens every time is that we tend to look at individual events. For instance, as you're watching that little dot move, you look at 1970 and you go, oh, yes, that was the oil shock, 1973, 4, 5. Then you look at here and you go, that was the recession of 1981. You look again and you go, that's the recession of the early 90s. And then you go, that's the growth of the early 2000s, but crashed by the global recession of 2008 and so on. And you're constantly talking about individual events. We will talk about the pandemic of 2020 and how that caused GDP to fall. And of course, the individual events are important. They matter. But step back and you can see that this thing is slowing down overall, because you cannot become ever more productive. It is not possible. We hit a peak of productivity in the 1950s, following a peak of innovation in the 1930s. We hit a peak of population growth in the 1960s. Things don't always go faster and faster and faster. Let's just look at China GDP, because China had one of the biggest rises in GDP in the world until recently. And you'll see for the early 2000s, it rising more each year than the year before. Slightly affected by 2008, but not greatly. Climbing to a new height of growth in 2010, and it slows down till 2015 when it rises again. And we're talking about huge increases, and then it begins to slow. And people began to worry towards the end of last year about what's happened to GDP growth in China. We can look at other things. We can look at stocks and shares. This is the NASDAQ. It's the share index in the United States, which began mainly with high-tech goods, Microsoft, Apple, these kind of things. And if you look at this, you see the value of shares in the 90s not just rising, but beginning to rise exponentially. Now, whenever anything rises exponentially, that has to stop. And it did stop shortly after 1996, as the next graph shows. And here is the next graph. The series taking a bit longer. And there's the dot-com crash. It looks like the arc of a roller coaster with a double loop. Going to come round again by 2006, 7, 8, 9, 10. And then it goes up and up and up again to reach a new height, 2018, 2019. Got much higher than this, actually. Before, of course, it crashed again with the pandemic. But it was going to crash with something, wasn't it? When you look at these loops, you can see they're loops. They go round. That's not saying that you can foretell the future. You can just foretell the rough shape of the future. You can't tell when shares are going to go up and down, otherwise you can make a fortune. But you know that they can't carry on rising in value forever. Something very much more human now, and less than 10 slides to go, if you're getting sick of watching these little dots move around. This is the average height of people in the world. People by the year in which they were born. And you can see that it was rising quite steadily until 1950, and then it begins to slow down. Now, it actually falls after 1978, but that's because the mix of who's in the world changes. So, in fact, average heights are not falling in any particular country. They're rising in every country of the world, the average height of human beings. But they're not rising as fast as they were rising for your parents and grandparents. So we're getting a slowdown in ourselves, in our bodies, and changes that occurred in our bodies. It's all pointing towards a kind of increase in stability, an increase in predictability in the future. I'm just going to show you something else which was rising exponentially, at least until recently. So if you remember before, I told you the only things I've managed to find that were rising exponentially were CO2 emissions and temperatures. Well, here's the third, the number of university graduates in the world as a proportion of young people, rising most recently to around about a third of all young people going to university at some point. But you can tell that this has to stop rising. I mean, it can't go above 100%. And it'll be good if it got to near 100%. But it will not rise at this 1 to 1.5% rate year after year after year. It will have to slow down. And it probably is slowing down at the moment with the pandemic. So that's the third thing that's accelerating. Most things are decelerating. Here's something which absolutely had to decelerate. It's the rate at which species are becoming extinct in the world, which peaked in 1984. We were killing more species, annihilating species in 1984 than any other time before or since. And then the rate of annihilation of species begins to fall. It didn't begin to fall because we were particularly conscientious. It began to fall because in the 1970s and 1980s, the majority of the very rare species on small islands were wiped out, and there were fewer and fewer very rare species to become extinct by more recent years. But it's a very fortunate trend. Well, still fairly disastrous. It's 70%, and these are large animals being lost by the year 2013. But if it had been faster than that, then we would be extinct as well. So I thought I'd just include that. Now, the fourth and I think final thing that was accelerating. So I'm trying to give you a sense of what's changing in the world. And here's the fourth one. The number of flights being taken in the world. Not the number of people flying. Most people in the world will never fly. Majority of people being born now in the world will never fly. Many of these flights are being taken by people who fly several times a year. But again, you can see that the graph moves in this direction. You see it moves towards the right. It's an acceleration. By the year 2017, 4 billion flights, 4,000 million, were being taken a year. The number of flights was not just rising, it was rising faster and faster and faster each year. 2013, 2014, 2015, 2016, 2017, adding 300 million more flights being taken than the year before. And that went up 2018, 2019, and then it crashed. Now it'll go up again. But the number of flights in the world may not get back to the number of flights that we did have in December and January of this year. May never get back up to that level. The cost of flying may increase and be such to deter people from flying. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, because flying, of course, is so polluting. It contributes to that carbon dioxide, which is accelerating, which contributes to the rise in temperature, which is still accelerating. So a few things are accelerating, but most things are not. About five more slides to go, so please start thinking of some questions. Back to babies again. Just to kind of give you an idea of the absolute numbers. By 1976, we were adding 110 million babies a year. By 1983, 120 million. By now, 135, and then it goes down in the 90s. Round again. Up again. And then down and down and down. Those loops are baby booms. The first baby boom happened round about here, 1950 and slightly earlier. It was the baby boom that came at the end of the Second World War. It was a baby boom that came with revolution in China. Whenever you have disruption and war, you get babies. It's the baby boom that came with partition in India. And after that baby boom, you get a slowdown. But then those babies get to the age where they can have babies, and they have the babies in the 1960s. And there's a slowdown. But then the grandchildren of those post-war baby boom babies, they have children, which is in the 80s. So the reason you get these loops are baby booms and echoes of baby booms. But by the year 2000, the echoes getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and then we get out of this, and then we head that way. And that is people deciding to have no children, or to just have one child, or at most to have two, with it being very, very rare to decide to have three or four children. It's a fundamental shift that's occurred. Lots of things are settling down. Life expectancy in the world was going up most quickly in the 1960s because infant mortality was falling most quickly in the 60s. It carries on going up in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, and little acceleration in the year 2000 as we got infant mortality really low. Now it's around about 73, 74 years. These are the projections by the World Bank. I think they're a bit silly because they think it's going to do this, going to go up like this. I think it's much more likely it'll wiggle around once more and settle maybe around 80 years time. But you can certainly agree with me, or I hope you can, if you look at the pattern from 1966 onwards, that there's been a slowdown in the rise of life expectancy. Back then it was rising by almost a year, by 0.8 of a year a year. By the 1970s it's rising by half a year a year. By the 1990s it's rising by only a fifth of a year a year. Little increase again, little slowdown again. We're settling towards something. We're settling towards a kind of, not an end of history at all, but something that's more predictable than we might have thought it would be. We've only got two more slides to go. This is a complicated one, but it's the last slide in the book, so I thought I would include it here. And it's about the change in the city of Tokyo. Tokyo is one of the biggest cities in the world. And if you remember, I showed you earlier that Japan has this slowing population. In fact, falling population. What this graph, it's spiraling around, is showing you is when was Tokyo growing in its centre? When was it growing in the suburbs? 1940s, 47, it grew in the suburbs. 1947, 1950, they built up tower blocks in the centre. 1955, 56, 1960, 1964, they began to suburbanise again, building in the suburbs. Then they began to build in the centre again. But can you see it's moving towards this point, the zero, zero point, the point of not changing anymore? And we find this very hard to imagine, but you just have to look at the city of Tokyo, a city that's slowing down, hardly rising in population anymore, a city that is going to stabilise, before London and New York stabilises. These diagrams, they're not new, they're used in mathematics and physics, they're used in particular for understanding how a pendulum swings. So here you've got a pendulum, and it's a pendulum slowing down. And so as it slows down, the diagram has it zooming into the centre. more and more and more slowly. These diagrams show you position and speed. Velocity on the x-axis, position on the y-axis. It's a way of looking at change. For when change becomes more regular, when you've got really high quality data, when you can actually begin to look at it and think, this isn't an error in my data, this is real. I'll show you one more time. Goes from point 1 to point 2 to point 3, back to point 4 and to point 1 again. And those points 1, 2, 3 and 4 are also on the phase portrait diagram. You will have found this almost certainly quite difficult to follow. I decided not to tell you that at the beginning because it'll put you off. But these graphs are strange. They're weird. You won't have seen them before. But what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to show you that what used to be the case, that we were speeding up faster and faster and faster, that people were having more and more children, which was the case when I was born in 1968, the biggest increase in children ever in the world, a 2% increase that year. Bigger than ever before in the history of the species, bigger than will ever happen again. That idea of speed, that idea of change, that incredible idea of just how different our lives are to our parents and our grandparents. Our lives are not quite as different to our children as they will be to our parents. This has all kinds of geographical implications. I put some of them up here on the last slide. It doesn't mean that everything is going to end. It doesn't mean that we're going to carry on living the way we are forever. It will still carry on changing. But it means that we are probably over the fastest changes that we will experience. And that change in future will be change which is less about material goods and things that produce carbon, which we have to reduce, and will be more about social changes in how we live with each other. I'm going to stop sharing my screen now. And I'm very happy to take any questions. And I really hope you could hear me throughout that, because I just have to trust that you could, because I couldn't see any of your faces. So thank you ever so much. Thank you.
I'm Professor Dolly, and I really thank you immensely for sharing with us your keen insights on the geography of slowdown. The compelling visualizations aptly illustrated your point that indeed slowdown is upon us, and it is better if we embrace it. The floor is now open for any questions the participants might have for Professor Dolly. We'll be taking questions through the chat box. So if there are a few questions, may I read them out to you?
Yes.
How is population? Professor, could you explain a little bit more on how did population growth in sub-Saharan African countries become negative? Can it be attributed to the growing level of education more than the governance and policies, or is it something else? This is the question posed by Mr. Ravi to you, sir.
Okay. Sub-Saharan Africa, when the rest of the world was decelerating in the 1980s, and population growth was still rising, but rising less quickly, that deceleration wasn't seen in Africa. And the coincidence, and there's been a paper written in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in February of last year on this, it coincided with structural adjustment. When the World Bank and the IMF said that countries in Africa had to reduce their public spending. And they reduced their public spending on schools, particularly schooling for girls. And as a result of girls leaving school earlier, because of the IMF and the World Bank, those girls tended to have an extra baby when they became young women. The result may be as many as a billion extra people on the planet, due in effect, unwittingly, to the IMF and the World Bank, not understanding what the effect of their policies would have been. This isn't a problem because world population is slowing. So we may get to 10 billion people, we may not. I don't think we're going to get to 11 billion people. But when people look at the countries of Africa and say, look how many people there are there, it's important to remember that the most important recent reason is the IMF and the World Bank making a mistake, which they now admit was a huge mistake. And also, of course, the share of world population of Africa has only recently gone back to what it was 400 years ago, because Africa was absolutely decimated by the slave trade. So in a way we're going back to a share of world population that we saw 400 or 500 years ago. Similar with China and India. It's really interesting to look back at estimates of population 400 or 500 years ago and to see, you know, Europe needs to shrink quite a lot more, but we are heading to a more stable distribution of people.
Now, Mr. Himanshu Gandhi wants to know, what are the statistical tools you have used to study these changes in population, GDP, etc.?
What are the statistical tools? The main thing is getting access to the data, and the data being of very, very high quality. So if the data is not of high quality, then as soon as you look at change between 2 years, it begins to just look like a kind of random spike. So that's the main thing. The only clever statistical thing I did, which makes the graphs look like they look, is I measured a rate of change, not at the point that I'm studying, but from the point just before to the point after. So if I'm looking at a population change, say in the year 2019, I measure it from 2018 to 2020 and divide by 2 for 2 years. That sounds really simple, but that one innovation of measuring change from the point before to the point after in everything you do makes the patterns much easier to understand, makes them far smoother.
So Dr. Rukma Chaturvedi says, very well explained, sir. Do you support slowdown of population, the one-child policy of China, and the growing population of developed nations?
I think in hindsight, the one-child population of China probably wasn't necessary. In hindsight, after, if you could have gone forward in time and looked at what was happening in the rest of the world, if the people in China had known and had decent statistics at the time, and they'd known that the average number of children in China had gone from 6 children per woman to 2 in one generation before the one child policy, then you could have seen that it need not have been as draconian as it was. And it wasn't necessary. And China has an interesting problem in future because it's not going to have enough young people. But if I'd been in China in the 1970s and early 1980s, I probably would have supported the policy given what they knew then. Sorry, a complicated answer. Now we don't have to worry at all about population. We really don't. It is falling everywhere. Everywhere in the world. Falling mainly because of the choices of women. The average woman in the world wants half a child less. It sounds odd. Half a child less than the average man. And increasingly everywhere, the average woman in the world is getting her wish more than the average man. And men are changing also. So it's a lovely thing to see in your lifetime. People, when they feel safe, and particularly when they know their children will almost certainly survive them, the trick is getting infant mortality really, really low. A few years ago, infant mortality fell in a year worldwide by 10%, unbelievably fast. So as soon as you know that your children will almost certainly live longer than you, you feel safe having one child or two children. That's the magical thing which has happened in our lifetimes.
Thank you for the expository talk, sir. So your prediction about slowdown look more and more real in a post-COVID scenario. Your comments, sir.
Yes, I finished the book. The book's called Slowdown, and I finished it in January. Didn't change anything. And it was published a few months ago in the middle of the pandemic. The pandemic does make slowdown easier to explain, and it means I get less criticism when I say I think everything is slowing down. I do include in the book information about previous pandemics, the 1918 pandemic, which world GDP fell by 14% that year, but then it rose by 16% the year after. We bounced back from that pandemic very quickly, and that's worldwide. Even India, which had the largest numbers of deaths in the world from that pandemic. The other big pandemics, fast ones, 1951, 1957, 1968, again we bounced back quickly. However, all those pandemics, they were flu, they all came at a time when there was acceleration in population, acceleration in GDP. This pandemic has hit at a time when we were already decelerating, when economic growth is already slowing, and also at a time when we're much more aware of what's going on. So I do worry about the economic slowdown, but I think this pandemic will not be a blip like those previous ones. It could well be the turning point at which we do decide we can afford to live with a little less. We just have to make sure that people don't go hungry, but we should not expect acceleration in future.
Mr. Ravi wants to ask you, your projections of life expectancy is indicative of gloomy outcomes of the health strategies prescribed under the health segments of the SDGs. Does it mean a restructuring of the SDGs are required now?
I'm just not as optimistic as the World Bank, because they could be right, but it just, when you look at the curves, the idea that we're suddenly going to get life expectancy rising quite so quickly. And it's partly because the majority of the reason for rising life expectancy so far in the world has been fewer infant and child deaths. Reducing infant and child deaths has by far the biggest effect. Improving life expectancy at older ages becomes harder and harder and harder to do. And so the idea that we're going to have life expectancy for the planet in the 80s and 90s, in a very short amount of time, within 20 or 30 or 40 years, I just think that's a little bit too optimistic. I could be wrong. It would be nice if I'm wrong. It's going to be great. It's going to be a planet absolutely full. Majority of people in the world will be old in the years to come. That will then settle down, and we'll head to a population pyramid which looks like that. But we are heading to a population pyramid which looks like this for places like China and so on.
Hello.
Hi there.
So Dr. V.K. Srivastava wants to ask you a question.
Go on.
Well, Dr. Darling, your paper is a research paper. I think you have done a lot of labor. At the first sight, within a few minutes, I could get an impression that you are a master of the slowdown. But now I think you should get a delete on the concept of the slowdown and its relation to the economy. The only thing that I would like to get elaborated from you is, what are the implications towards human development? All the variables that you have taken into account, and you have made a good analysis based on larger countries, smaller countries, and different regions. What implications do arise on the theme that we are discussing in this webinar, that is the impact on human development and sustainability of development? Could you please elaborate?
Thank you for that question. It's a very big question. The kind of issues that I think arise are that population falls, which we're beginning to see, are happening first in the richest countries, like Japan. They're happening in many parts of Europe. The population is falling in many parts of Spain, parts of Italy, many parts of Germany. We're actually getting fewer people. That isn't a problem unless you have rigid borders. And if you have rigid borders, so people can't come in to areas which have got houses built, which have got sewer systems built, but where the population is falling, then there is a problem. In the poorer parts of the world, The economies are on average doing better, that is still growing, compared recently to the richest. This has only been since the year 2010. Only since around about 2010 have we seen the United States, Europe and Japan shrinking in terms of its share of global GDP, and the poor parts of the world widening. So it's very, very recent that this has occurred. It's very hard to prophesy what will happen in future. But particularly if you look at the way that this particular disease, COVID, moved around the planet. It moved between the richest countries first at the highest rates, which are most interconnected. And it slowed them down, and it revealed the weaknesses and the dependencies of the places which had the highest GDP. And how, despite the fact that places like Europe and Korea and Japan and North America may look very sophisticated, when it comes to simply providing shelter for people who need it, or food for people who need it, they're not necessarily that good at doing it. I do think we're looking at a more equal world in future. However, you have to work for that. Because if you don't, it doesn't just happen. If you don't keep a good eye on what is going on, I'm afraid the world's billionaires will take more and more and more. It's a separate thing. I study inequality separately. But the last thing to say on that is, when the world was growing, when the population was growing faster and faster, when GDP was growing faster and faster and faster, you could tell people, just be patient. You'll get your time. One day you can be rich, you can have more. When the world is slowing, when a number of people, the size of markets, are not getting larger and larger in future, when the wealth of the world is not getting bigger and bigger, telling people to wait your time and then you too will be well off doesn't work as a message anymore. So you have to work out how to share what you have better. Japan and China are going to have to work out how to get used to the idea that younger people from other parts of the world are probably going to have to move there. Because what is the point of building an enormous city in China if the population is dropping by 30% and 30% again, and your city has already been built? So these are the really complicated stories for the rest of the world. Stability in India. Population stability in India, in Bangladesh and in Pakistan. This is so recent. It was unimagined 20 years ago. We've been used to, we have a model that assumes that everything gets bigger, because that's what it had been doing for 100 years. That if you sell Coca-Cola, you'll always make a profit, because there'll be more children to buy bottles of Coca-Cola from you. Now, the basic model of making a profit by selling Coca-Cola no longer works. And the company, Coca-Cola, who make Coke, know this. And they've been trying to find different things to do. And what's slightly worrying for them is that nothing is as profitable as selling Coca-Cola, but they cannot carry on making a profit selling Coca-Cola, A, because there are fewer children who will buy it, but also it's not very good for your teeth either. So I think we're living in interesting times. Just because things are slowing down doesn't mean that they will get better, but as long as people are aware that they could be better, I think we have a very good chance.
Oh, well, thank you, sir. Very good. Sir. It's very interesting.
Thank you.
That you have also brought in the question of climate change, and that is also slowing down and may solve many of the problems faced by the world today. Just one reference, if you allow me,
yes.
A few seconds. Dr. Darling, I had a brief stint in Oxford University Geography Department in 1972-73, when I was invited by Professor Peter Hewitt to share my views on a conference on retailing.
Yes.
And that actually that has given me much more pleasure to listen to you from the same place and listen in such a good way, such an excellent analysis and study. I thank you very much. Thank you. All the observations.
Thank you very much for your questions. Thank you.
So just two more questions, sir.
Okay.
Ms. Sonali Yadav wants to know, she wants to thank you for your insightful talk and says, the concept of sustainable development has gained some notoriety and has become a buzzword due to its multiple definitions and interpretation. What, in your opinion, is the path of sustainable development in the 21st century, apart from what you rightly mentioned, slow down? Your comments on socio-political directions in which you see the world moving.
Let me just use the example of air flights. So I showed you a graph showing that I think it was around about 4 billion air flights were taken in the most recent year, maybe slightly higher. The majority of those flights are taken by a very small number of people, including normally people like me. When the pandemic hit, I had 10 air flights cancelled. I didn't realise how much I was flying. So I am one of those small numbers of people who fly many, many, many times a year. Sustainable development depends on people like me reducing our flights dramatically, maybe just once or twice a year instead of many times a year. It depends on people like me living in just one house, not having two houses, not commuting between them, not using up unfair resources. It requires people like me not to drive cars that pollute as much. And where you are, it requires the 10% who are best off where you are to be more careful about their pollution. Because the best off, the most wealthy 10% of people where you are will almost certainly cause more pollution in terms of CO2 than the majority of the rest of the population, apart from stoves, which are a separate issue. But sustainability, environmentally, ultimately depends on greater control and less consumption by the best off people on the planet. It requires us to buy clothes and use them until they wear out. And it primarily doesn't affect the poorest people on the planet. And doing things like this, talking by Zoom, my wife just walked through the back because I'm in a corridor in my house, is where I work. It would be lovely to come and actually physically see you, but as we can see, it is entirely possible for us to do it this way, and so I didn't need to take a car to Heathrow Airport, to get a plane from Heathrow, to fly to you, to get another car, which would take me to where you are, to stay in a hotel, which would have been nice, you know. We've been forced to do this, because travelling is great, but for somebody like me, who gets to travel a lot, and the other people like me in the world who produce the bulk of pollution, reducing what we do is the biggest change. And then making sure that there are opportunities in the world so people don't try to fly as much as they can, other people don't try and buy as much as they can, don't see having a huge amount of material wealth as a sign of success. When I was at school, the good doctor was saying about, because I grew up in Oxford, so I was at nursery school when you were here in the 1970s. When I was at school in the 1980s, I was taught from my geography A level that an ice age was coming and the world was going to get cooler. And I had to say the world is going to get cooler to get my marks in geography. So it's only really been 40 years in which we've gone from thinking the world is cooling down to realising it isn't just heating up, but it's heating up faster and faster and faster. The temperature charts yesterday for Siberia are extremely frightening. But the reason I don't want you to be upset about this is 40 years is a very short amount of time to learn this. And it does mean that we're going to have to live and behave in ways where we don't do things which damage the planet as much as we have been doing, a lot of which we really didn't quite understand until very recently. The last 10 years of global warming have been absolutely exceptional. And you might have noticed in the last 10 years, the people who don't believe in global warming have all gone quiet, because it is unarguable now that the planet is warming up.
So the final question for the day?
Yes.
Ms. Swati Singh wants to know, if we look closely, we find that poor people are having more babies as compared to that of financially stable people. What is your opinion at this tendency and its impact?
Yes, it's interesting. Although people in Britain often suspect that richer people in Britain are having more babies because they can afford to have them. Maybe three babies or four. There's been many, many studies on this. The number of babies are coming down overall, but a poor family is more likely in India to have three or four, say, and a rich family much more likely to have one. And an aspirational family more likely to have one, because your chance of your child doing well socially is higher if you can put all your resources into them. When I've studied countries around the world, what in terms of fertility, what I found is that the number of babies inside any country is lowest amongst the poor where there is the greatest equality. So if you have a high degree of inequality in a country, poorer people will have more babies for all kinds of reasons. One is it's a way to show success. It creates labourers who can work with you and somebody to look after you when you're old as well. In India, I think I may be wrong, but I think in India it may still be Kerala which has the lowest number of babies being born. You can tell me if I've got this wrong, it's years ago. And Kerala is one of the more equal states in India. But you see the same thing everywhere else around the world. In Europe, one of the lowest rates of having babies is in Finland. And in Finland, Finland is the most equitable country in Europe. 2 years ago, Finland had the lowest infant mortality rate in the world. In the whole of Finland, which is a country of 5-6 million people, only 97 babies died in 1 year. Less than 100 babies died in the entire country. When things get like that, it has an enormous effect on the number of children that people have. Because we have to remember how fast this has changed. My grandparents were born, two of my grandparents, when Queen Victoria was alive, just. And they were children at a time when 1 in 10 of the children of the richest servant-keeping classes in England died before the age of 5. So we've gone in 100 years from your children may well die before they become adults to your children will almost certainly be okay. And this utterly changes everything, and it's really, really good news. And thank you again ever so much for letting me speak. Lovely way to start a Monday for me.
I'm sure that many of the participants would have liked to ask more questions, but due to the paucity of time, we won't be able to take any more questions. Despite his ardent desire, Professor Dowling won't be able to stay with us any further, as he has prior commitments which he has to honour. I would now like to request Dr. A.C. Scott to thank Professor Dowling and to also introduce the theme for the plenary session of day one, which has been perfectly set up by the keynote address, the geography of slowdown and regional disparity. Over to you, ma'am.